and welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs. I'm your host, Katie Harbeth. Today, we're inviting Brian Fishman onto the show. Brian is a counterterrorism expert who has spent a lot of time both in the military, in the government. He worked for 5 years at Facebook and then now has co-founded a company called Cinder, which helps companies, tech companies in particular, work on trust and safety issues. I wanted to bring Brian into this conversation because I think that he has had one of those careers where he's always sort of been on the cutting edge of these issues, where there is no playbook, where you were kind of starting in the beginning that today, when you go back and look at it, seems very rudimentary in the types of things that you were doing, but you were trying to figure it out as you went along. And I think Brian has some really great insights of that, of how to be weighing trade-offs when you aren't quite sure what the consequences of the decisions that you're going to be making are. We talk about the role of the media. We talk about the role of Hollywood. We talk about how different tech companies and the nuances that go into making some of these decisions exist. And we kind of talk about regulation and the impact of that. So I hope you really enjoy it. Make sure you stick to the end where we both talk about TV shows that we're planning. I love both of them, but it's a great conversation and I hope you enjoy it. Brian Fishman, welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs. I'm excited to have you.
Thanks, Katie. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start first for those of you who might not know you, for you to just give a little bit of an introduction of yourself and like the work that you do.
Well, my name is Brian Fishman, and I'm currently the co-founder and chief strategy officer at Cinder, which is a platform for platform governance. And we work on trust and safety. We work on responsible AI. We work on a range of different issues. My background is really in studying terrorism. I taught at West Point in a place called the Combating Terrorism Center. And then sort of most importantly for this context, led the work at Meta or then Facebook around dangerous organizations, which was terrorist organizations, hate groups, large scale criminal organizations, et cetera.
So I want to dig in a little bit more into both like your journey into Facebook and also into Cinder, because one of the things that struck me when we chatted a couple of months ago was sort of being on the cutting edge of different technologies and issues where there really isn't much of a playbook. And I'm wondering if you can take us back a little bit to, if I remember right, it was sort of around the 9/11 era and stuff like that, that where you got a lot of your career started. Is that right?
Yeah. So I graduated from college in 2001 and moved to DC on September 10th, 2001. So 9/11 was literally my first morning waking up in DC. And you know, I think in a lot of ways, my career has been defined by that event, right? I went to work on Capitol Hill for a couple of years and then was in grad school in New York and then was hired to teach at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, which was stood up to, you know, provide academic instruction to cadets that were going to go off and be future Army officers around terrorism, which was not, you know, it sounds strange to say today, but, you know, pre-9/11, that was an area that didn't get a lot of study. People weren't really thinking about it. There had been a moment in the sort of 80s, late 80s, where there was a lot of focus on terrorism, but that had waned through the 90s from an academic perspective. And so we started doing research. And one of the really interesting dynamics back then was that we were at the very cutting edge of using the internet for research on terrorist organizations. And people think about that as a social media problem, but the reality is that these kinds of movements have used, you know, digital tools to communicate for as long as those digital tools have existed. But I think researchers hadn't caught up to that. And so we did a lot of what is now called open source research or open source intelligence using techniques that were incredibly basic by the standards of, I think, the most cutting edge researchers today. But that at the time, were still giving us a ton of insight going to Al-Qaeda web forums and literally just reading what people were saying, understanding and downloading, you know, the books and the propaganda that they were developing. And that sounds sort of like the ante today. But at the time, that was pretty innovative. And it gave us insight that other people didn't have.
And you were building up expertise, it sounds like, as you were trying to figure it out in using those new tools to try to figure. And I think that that's the reason I wanted to ask you that question is I think it's really important in this age of AI where we're at right now. I just see a lot of similarities to those early internet days and early social media days of just trying to kind of figure this stuff out. And like, when we look back on this day and age in AI in 10 years, people are gonna be like, well, that seems super simple. And it's like, well, yeah, this all stuff starts in that kind of spot.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, you know, we operated like a startup. We were an academic center at a military institute, you know, at a military institution. I was technically a Department of Army employee at the time. We didn't really act like it. We acted like academics. But there was this notion that we were creating something new and we could do what we needed to do to get the answers. And so there wasn't a lot of bureaucracy, you know, and so we would go and we would just show up on these websites and download what we wanted to download. And there was, you know, our security posture was probably not as good as it should have been. And like, there were a lot of trade-offs there, but the upside was that we were able to move at the speed of the internet. We were able to learn at the speed that our adversaries were learning about how to use these new digital forums. And I think that you know, put us in a position to learn things really quickly and develop some of the sort of techniques that I think now are kind of par for the course. You know, I mean, they're worse than that. They're like really, really basic kinds of techniques, but they gave us a ton of insight. And part of that was that, you know, bad actors on the internet at that point were also much less sophisticated than they are today. They were doing a ton of stuff out in the open. They didn't realize that you could sort of gather data and cross-reference across platforms. They didn't understand the metadata that was attached to the various content that they were putting out. You know, they weren't thinking through all of that stuff. And so there were a lot of insights to be had.
So then what made you pivot then into tech and into Meta? Well, I guess then it was Facebook.
Yeah. So I had worked. So I was there at West Point, and then I went back down to DC. I worked in a think tank at New America for a couple of years. And then I went to, I was looking to get back to California. I'm a Californian originally, and wound up working for a company called Palantir doing disaster relief work, which was really fun and interesting. And that was also a situation where it was like, hey, there's this new technology. No one's quite sure how to use it. Go use it in these sort of novel settings, you know, doing disaster relief stuff, which was a lot of fun. Then I got angry because I thought after the rise of sort of ISIS in Syria, there was a lot of discourse around that movement that I felt was detached from the history of that particular organization, which I knew a lot about because I'd studied it in depth. And so I left Palantir to write a book. I did that. And as I was writing this book about the history of the Islamic State, of the so-called Islamic State, I was introduced to some of the policy leadership at Meta that was having a really severe problem dealing with ISIS content on Facebook at the time. And I still lived in Menlo Park, literally just happenstance kind of down the street. And went down there, we hit it off with, you know, some of the folks there, and they brought me on in spring of 2016. So, you know, I think like many sort of career opportunities, it's, you know, you put yourself in a position to be successful, but there's also some luck involved. You know, you're in the right place at the right time when somebody needs what you can bring to the table.
And then now pivoting to starting Cinder, what was the impetus for that? And like, why did you want to do that?
Well, so when did I leave Facebook? I left Facebook in November 2021. And I think I'd been there for 5.5 years, the longest job I ever held. It was a great job. I really feel lucky to have had it, even though it was a very hard and exhausting job, as you can well understand. And so I was ready for something new, and I was ready for something different. And I left to go find that. And so I really give a lot of credit to my co-founders, Glenn Wise, Phil Brennan and Declan Cummings, but Glenn really was the one that sort of said, there are a bunch of tools that we've seen developed at Meta, and we've seen the impact of better trust and safety tooling on outcomes that we have. And there ought to be a suite of those tools that is available to all platforms, because we're going to see increased performance, better efficiency, better accuracy in those decisions. And if you get your data in order and set up an effective platform, then you're going to be able to more effectively use new tools that are coming down the pipe, like AI, for trust and safety purposes. And I was really intrigued by this idea. I think many folks that have worked in trust and safety have said, why aren't the tools better? Why aren't the platforms better? Many of us have had that thought. And, you know, I really give Glenn a tremendous amount of credit for actually saying, you know what, I'm going to start writing an MVP and get this thing off the ground. And he came to me originally and said, hey, will you be an advisor to this project? I said, yes. you know, sure, I'll take a percentage for doing very little. But then I came back because I fell in love with the idea and said, hey, why don't I come in more fully and let's work this out? And we did.
Amazing. And for those that don't know, MVP in this instance stands for minimally viable product, not most valuable person. I sometimes like to remind because there's all these acronyms that are out there. And sometimes like the first time I heard it in tech, I was like, what? And then I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense.
I don't know, Katie. I still have a hard time dealing with the fact that I speak tech now. I still think of myself as like a policy national security guy, which is true in my soul, but like, you know, now I speak tech.
You speak both. I mean, there you translate between the two. It's just you have to remember sometimes when you start getting into the acronym alphabet soup for everybody around what that could mean. Before we, pivot, I want to ask about pivoting a little bit more and sort of, you know, there's a lot of people who are in this spot right now. They were laid off by the tech companies or, you know, the job market overall is not great. There's a lot of people I talk to that are thinking about going out on their own or trying to think about a new job. Their jobs themselves are pivoting inside the company. And so I'm curious if you have any lessons learned or how you've tried to think about that in your own career and life to recognize when you need to make those pivots and weigh the trade-offs that come with doing so.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to trust your gut on what you want to be doing on, you know, on a daily basis and what you want to be focused on. I do think that it's easy to say and it's a luxury in so many ways, but I think, you know, you're going to do a better job if you're happy in what you're doing and inspired by the work, the challenge, the content, whatever, you know, your colleagues, whatever it is. I think anytime you're trying to do something new, and I have had the sort of the great opportunity to do new things, you know, there's a tension there. You have to have a certain level of audacity to sort of stand up and say, you know what, I've got good ideas here. They're new. No one's got better ideas. I can go out there and launch these and make them real. At the same time, if you launch into a new space and you're not humbled, then, you know, you're actually not pushing the limits. You're not, if you're not putting yourself in a position to be wrong some of the time, then you're not actually pushing the limits. And I think that's particularly the case in an area that is as dynamic and challenging as, you know, trust and safety and dealing with evasive bad actors on platforms that themselves are evolving extraordinarily quickly. So when I think about what leads to success at a place like, you know, in a field like trust and safety, it is finding that mix of audacity and humility. Many of the ideas that I came into Facebook with when I went there, you know, you learn very quickly that like, it's just not as simple as maybe you thought it was. You know, I'll tell you an example of that, right? I remember getting to Facebook and thinking, well, why aren't we just using user reports better, right? Like there was all these users reporting things. I think there's a very common attitude 5 years ago among people that hadn't actually worked for platforms. But of course, when you come in the door and you realize, especially in the, you know, the dangerous organization space at the time, 95% of user reports did not identify violating content. You know, it was users abusing the reporting systems to try to, you know, maybe it was fun and games. Maybe they're actually trying to get you to take down stuff that they simply don't like, but not things that are actually violative. And the lesson there is, you know, you really have to understand that every surface of a platform, including the surfaces that are designed to keep the platform safe, are a potential vector for attack. And I think that's humility there, because like the lesson there can't just be, oh, I don't know everything. The lesson has to be, even when I design solutions, they're going to come with downsides too. And they're going to come with consequences that I don't intend. And we have to try to anticipate those, but we're not going to be perfect. And I think there's a lot of lessons there for product development generally, certainly for AI, but I think, you know, I suspect there are a lot of people that understand trust and safety nodding along here because they've seen those unintended consequences and they understand that when you do something that seemingly makes sense, there's going to be second and third order consequences that are maybe consequences worth accepting, but that are going to come with some negative repercussions.
That's what I love. I don't know if you've ever played Mike Masnick's game, the Trust and Safety Tycoon game. I'll put that in the show notes for people. If you've not done that, that really puts you in the hot seat of trying to make some of those tough trade-offs for sure.
Totally. Right. I think it's really good. I mean, because, you know, I mean, it's, in some ways it's contrived. It's a game, right? You know, it really succeeds in forcing you to face trade-offs. And there's just no easy win without some consequence that you're going to have to deal with. Now, the challenge is in the real world, oftentimes you're not quite sure what you're trading off. You try to identify the pros and the cons, but there's some ambiguity there.
Do you have frameworks that you like to use when you are trying to weigh those trade-offs, when you've got imperfect information and you've got chaos and stress and a lot of pressure to, I mean, it's quite the environment that you know, you're generally in when you're facing some of these toughest things.
Well, I do think that there are real challenges, especially in the trust and safety space. When I was working on dangerous organizations, you know, my job in a lot of ways was to try to insulate the folks that were doing the real work from the, you know, the political dynamics of a place like Facebook, which of course exist, right? And you want people that are working at the sort of operational level to focus on the work and not get caught up in that stuff. And the teams there would laugh at me sometimes because I would say, look, what we're going to focus on here is what prevents real world harm as much as we possibly can. And the irony is that there is sometimes a tension between preventing real world harm and preventing the sorts of violations that generate bad publicity, that get more attention by regulators, right? And so there can be real tension there. And I think that, you know, most importantly, I want regulators to understand that sometimes it is the stuff deeper down, that it is the sort of investigative stuff, finding the very few people that are actually organizing real world harm, like killing people, blowing stuff up, murdering people in the real world. That's not the stuff that usually gets reported. The stuff that usually gets reported and identified by the media and by regulators is the stuff that is higher scale, that gets more eyeballs. And those things can be really bad. That kind of stuff can be really deleterious to democratic process, to sort of social trust more generally. But the truly acute stuff oftentimes doesn't get caught in that. And where that gets really hard is both you get a bunch of, you know, political pressure and media pressure around the more higher scale stuff, but also from an engineering standpoint, it's really hard to move a needle on those very small number, very acute, very uncommon events. And so from an engineering standpoint, it can be hard to get companies to invest in that stuff, because if you've done a good job, nothing happens. And it's really hard to measure it. You know, it's classic counterterrorism problem. Did nothing happen because we did a good job, or did nothing happen because nothing was going to happen? You know, and I think that platforms face that, and folks that are really worried about those acute harms, which do happen, and they are not the things that get the most attention. I think it is really difficult to sort of focus on that stuff. And but we saw that enough times in a Facebook context that I was very insistent on trying to keep the teams that reported to me and that I sort of guided in more informal ways focused on, like, there is real world harm out there. People die sometimes if we get it wrong. And so we need to get at that acute stuff, because there were a bunch of other forces that were pushing us to do the other stuff. So I wanted to be a force in those kinds of things, to be pushing for those things that were not as visible as much as possible. And, you know, striking, there's obviously a balance to be struck there in the real world, but I think one of your jobs as a leader is to understand where the incentives are pushing and make sure that sort of general incentives don't overwhelm everything else. And you need to sort of create some in another direction. You try to do that, and so that your enterprise as a whole prioritizes holistically the things that need to be prioritized.
So that goes well into sort of my next question of, like, we're obviously in a time of a lot of rapid change now. We're going to be for quite some time of a lot of rapid change. How are you looking at the tech industry as a whole, but also just sort of overall these types of issues? You know, there's the short term and that we have all these elections happening this year, but then there's a medium and long term of, you know, I've just been looking at the next 5 to 8 years and, man, are we in for a lot? I think, you know, when you kind of look at it longer term, that it's just hard to be prepared for, because you can be both scared by it and terrified by it. But then I find it to be bringing a lot of new fascinating problems that we're going to have to tackle. So I'm curious how you're kind of thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of different sort of pressures happening in industry around trust and safety. One is obviously AI and the sort of rise of sort of synthetic content and synthetic agents that are going to be able to do more and more, both online, but also into the real world. And I think that that's going to cut both ways. I think the biggest challenge there is going to be, as a society, figuring out what we can trust. I do think that, and I think the hopeful interpretation is that this will actually reinforce the importance of institutions that can certify that things are real. But I think that's a pretty optimistic view. And there's going to be a lot of downsides here because our faith in institutions has fallen so far, because this sort of the sheer volume of content out there is going to crowd out what institutions can produce. And I think ultimately, a lot of the responsibility is going to fall on consumers to be able to sort of sort through this. And my hope is that consumers put a real demand on the marketplace to surface things that can be actually be certified and verified and are reliable. And media is obviously one place that you do that, and it's critical. So that's one. The other, obviously, in the trust and safety space is regulation. Overall, I think what regulation is doing is it's going to raise the floor for trust and safety expectations, but probably lower the ceiling, is the way that I think about it. And I think that's I don't know if that's a controversial statement. I think that there are a lot of regulators that want to believe that it's going to raise the floor and raise the ceiling. But unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the case in a lot of circumstances. You know, for the platforms that are already doing a lot, you know, I think they're going to wind up focusing on the specific rules that regulators impose, where they might suffer consequences, fines, et cetera, when in fact platform rules are actually broader in many cases than what the regulatory, you know, what regulations actually put in place. So I worry about that. And I hope that regulators are attuned to it, you know, because I think it's, you know, at this point, that's a hypothesis. We should test it and see if it's true, right? But I hope regulators are really have their eyes open and are interested in looking to test that hypothesis rather than just make assumptions about what their intent, their good intent, hopefully, produces. And they'll need to do that. And academics are going to have to hold the regulators to account just as much as they've intended over the past years to hold the platforms to account. Otherwise, we're not going to wind up in a good place in 5-10 years.
Well, and I think regulators are just on the cusp of discovering how hard it is to enforce these things, right? As we know who's been in the industry, there's a difference between writing the policy and actually being able to enforce said policy. And I get so many questions from people being like, okay, just give me the formula for how I comply with the DSA. And it's like, eh, there's not actually a formula, right? Like it's all going to depend how they choose to enforce it.
Totally. I think it's absolutely fair for regulators to say the incentive structures of private companies are such that we can't trust them to make these really difficult decisions. But that doesn't actually mean that those decisions get any easier when you remove those potentially perverse incentive structures. And I think that you're seeing that with the regulators. And you know, frankly, you're seeing it around the sort of quote unquote content moderation decisions of universities dealing with all of these protests, right? I mean, obviously that has a, you know, a real world dynamic that is more visceral. There is a threat of real world harm in a slightly different way, potentially because people are there in physical space. At the same time, I think nobody's looking at all of these brilliant academics and saying, oh, they've figured out how to manage this content moderation problem that they face and these speech issues on their campuses, right? Some have dealt with it better than others. But these are incredibly difficult questions, regardless of who is trying to resolve them. And you may think that having the financial motivations of private companies is a distortive incentive structure that needs to be replaced by regulators. But I think if you look around, anytime these sorts of questions come up, they're just fundamentally very difficult. And transferring responsibility is not going to make them easier necessarily.
No, this is where I keep thinking that it's going to be over time, we're just going to have to create this system of checks and balances because nobody trusts any one entity in which to make the right decision. And everyone's going to be flawed and have different incentive structures. And so you're going to have some sort of way for all of these groups to kind of be like, okay, these guys are making a decision. Either how are you a part of that? How do you hold them accountable? Understand the impacts? Like, we don't have a lot of that today. Like, it's still very early days of that.
Yeah, ambition checking ambition. You know, it's like Federalist Papers, right? No, I mean, I think there's fundamental wisdom there, I think. But, you know, the challenge is just the sheer number of these kinds of decisions and And the idea that, you know, this is when I talk to AI companies, this is a really interesting dynamic, right? Where you're not making in trust and safety incredibly detailed, judicial-like decisions every time. You are setting up these systems that make these decisions at really high scale. You know, setting in guardrails around AI certainly falls into that category, though I think a lot of the big companies have used those kinds of techniques and systems in the past. You know, but what you're doing is sort of setting up systems where when you're using, you know, especially when you're using AI, you could predict how often you're going to be wrong, you know, and you can put a number on it. You know, how often are we going to have a false positive? How often are we going to have a false negative? And if you make decisions at extraordinary scale, those numbers of errors get really big. And yet your system might still be right, even if it's producing some of those errors, right? Or, you know, you're never going to be able to eliminate all of those errors. And I think one of the great challenges that we have is we don't have clarity on like how many errors are acceptable, you know? And I like, it's really ugly, but like you look at the regulatory stuff of like, you know, how many rat parts are allowed to be in a box of cereal kind of thing, right? And like, you know, that's sort of a terrible way to think about it. But like, ultimately, this is where we're going to have to get like how many rat parts are going to be acceptable on your big social media platform. And the danger from a regulatory perspective of setting that standard is that it both raises the floor, but it also gives a platform the ability to say, well, we met your standard. And even though there were all these bad things, we still met your standard. And it's not clear to me that we've matured enough as a sort of society and a body politic to understand and sort of grok that reality that perfection is out of reach, even though, and you're going to have effective systems that still have these errors in them. There's the expectation, some of it as a result of the sort of cult of personality, or the cult of technology around Silicon Valley, that perfection is achievable, and it just isn't. And I don't quite know how we reset those expectations, but I think it's really important that we do so. And it's going to require more honesty from industry, from regulators, and sort of a clear understanding of the limitations of the technology that is out there.
I want to shift to the role of the media, because you brought that up, and this has been a particular gripe of mine as well, around headlines and stuff, around this. You know, there's so much going on that a lot of stories can get lost, or it's also hard to really pull out nuance in a lot of these stories that you see. There is one just recently about, you know, ads in India that are being run by shadow groups, and you know, the way you read it, I read it and they're like, man, they're expecting Facebook to like handle every part of the campaign finance system, when it's like kind of near impossible for the company to do. But it's sort of like you don't see them putting as much pressure on the Electoral Commission or others to like do that as well. But anyways, I'm curious, you know, you've put out on Threads a bit about some stories, particularly around Sudan and other places that you think aren't getting enough attention. And I was wondering if you could expand on that a bit.
So I think the Sudan issue, I think, you know, is really pertinent. I mean, there's really critical focus right now that like international news is dominated by the situation in Israel and Gaza. And that's merited given the political importance and the sort of second and third tier effects, not to mention the sort of humanitarian crisis that exists today and the like continued situation with hostages held in Gaza. But I worry that when there is an event like this that happens, it drowns out these other sort of situations around the world, some of which are really politically resonant, but some of which are just true humanitarian crises on an extraordinary scale. And the situation in Sudan is one of those. And it's very hard at the end of the day. You know, sometimes like you talk about an organization, you can say you can only have one or two priorities. I feel like, you know, the sort of national media can only have one or two priorities at a time, you know, and you see that when you see that kind of coverage and like, I think a relative dearth of coverage of, you know, a famine and a war, like what's happening in Sudan. So I see that dynamic. But the other thing that, you know, is more relevant to the tech part of this is that I think sometimes there is a bifurcation in media about which parts of a media enterprise cover certain things. And so what drives this for me was doing all this research on Al-Qaeda, you know, and their operations online in the early 2000s. And there was media coverage of that dynamic, but it didn't come from the technology desks. It came from the national security reporters, right? And they were writing about this sort of a, like abuse and use of, you know, web forums by terrorist organizations. But that didn't get covered by like the tech desks in the same way until it moved to larger companies, social media companies, that were the focus of tech coverage more generally because of it was you know, they were covering the rise of Facebook and they were covering the rise of YouTube and these sorts of institutions. Once you get to 2008, 2009, and you start to see a little bit of the sort of coverage. And what gets lost there is that these sorts of organizations were actually doing these kinds of activities even before social media was around. The reason why I think that matters is because it creates a distortive understanding that these kinds of dynamics are all brand new. And where you see that is that it translates into public understanding and even legislation. So Jonathan Haidt, you know, before he was focused on the impact on children, he did a lot of work looking at the impact of social media on political violence and created a really great bibliography that goes back to 2014, right? And so, of course, if you're setting up your time frame of when you're looking at the, you know, sort of manifestation of violence online and your scope is 2014 forward, you're going to be thinking about social media, but you fail to recognize there. And so you think that what's driving it is social media. And what you fail to recognize is that these kinds of militant organizations were using the internet even before these social media platforms. And that doesn't, I think social media platforms were very slow to deal with these kinds of problems. I think it's still a rampant issue, but I think what winds up happening here is that when we fail to understand the actors, the offline actors, and the way that they have approached technology, technologists, and especially even journalists that cover technology, they focus on the technology specifically rather than the actors. And that distorts their view. They wind up thinking it's all just about the technology rather than the actors themselves and the way that they approach the technology. So I'll give a little plug. Next month, there is going to be a conference in Swansea, Wales at called the Terrorism and Social Media Conference. I'm going to have been lucky enough to be invited to keynote it. But that's the conference among the nerdy people that study political violence and how it manifests on social media. Those are not the people driving the coverage and the thinking about political violence online. The people that are driving that are the communications experts that are looking at, you know, that think that the medium is the message. And the medium is part of the message, but so are the fact that there are these bad actors out there that they're going to use any medium they can to get their message out. And I think that gets lost. I think it's a basic point that gets lost. And if you look at the way these organizations and these actors evolve over time, it becomes more clear. But the way that the media covers this stuff, I think, often fails to capture that duration and that evolution over time and presents everything as new. And when you present everything as new, it seems like it's a function of the technology as opposed to understanding the balance between the technology and the people involved.
So another industry that also plays a big role in this is Hollywood. And recently, one Aaron Sorkin of West Wing, for those of you who know, I'm a huge fan of the West Wing and many of his other shows, has said he's writing a screenplay around January 6th, meant to be sort of a sequel to the Social Network movie that he did back in 2010, I think it was, or 2011 when that movie came out. I remember my parents watching that when they were like, what is this company that you're going to work for? And they're like, are you going to be ziplining off a house? And I was like, nah, they've moved to a slightly bigger office now. But you wrote a little bit on Threads on that. Like that's, you know, a movie like that can really shape the historical narrative around what this, you know, how people remember these events and what they looked like. And I'm, you know, if Mr. Sorkin were to call you up today and ask you to be advisor to him in writing this screenplay, what would you recommend to him?
I think that you have to make sure that you actually read the indictments of people convicted for the January 6th attacks. And if you do that, you will see that Facebook and Messenger were part of the communication infrastructure that they used. But if you want to tell a story about how January 6th manifested and the sort of media environment around that, meaning both broadcast and cable news, but also radio and the internet, it's not just Facebook. And there is a wider ecosystem there that I think is really, really important. I think there was a bevy of information after the election attempting to delegitimize it. Some of that certainly happened on Facebook, but a lot of it happened in other places as well. And when you look at the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers convictions, a lot, you know, in particular, a lot of their activities was on Telegram and Signal and their planning activities. And I think that if you're going to tell that story around communication on January 6th, you need to capture all of that. You need to capture, you know, the Donald, what was it, the Donald.com? I forget. You need to capture the sort of the Oath Keepers sort of core website. You need to capture Facebook and Messenger, but you'd also need to capture some of the stuff that was coming out of Fox and the sort of normalization of the delegitimization of our political process that happened in spaces that where there should have been better gatekeeping. Right. It's not just that we're in a space where there are no gatekeepers. It's that the gatekeepers aren't gatekeeping. And I think that Sorkin should try to capture all of that. One of the things I did after I left Facebook, actually, I haven't told anybody this. This is, you're breaking me. This, it's not worthy of breaking news. But but as I wrote a treatment for a TV show about what I think would be the most interesting story about Silicon Valley and trust and safety, which is not actually what does Zuck think and the decisions he makes. It's moderators in Dublin, Ireland, and the way that they operate and interact with these kinds of harms. Because, you know, I think of all the places at Facebook, the most fascinating was the Dublin office, where you have these people from all over the world, truly as a mini United Nations, wrestling with these incredibly difficult political questions. And they're bringing their own perspectives on that, which do not always align with each other. They don't always align with what Brian Fishman was deciding in Menlo Park. But overall, they're incredibly professional. They do their job well. They are, you know, working really hard. And I don't know. I hope at some point we get to the point where we can tell stories around this difficulty and trust and safety and the way these challenges manifest in a way that I think is more honest to the challenges and frankly honors those kinds of folks that do a lot of good every day. And it kind of gets lost, you know, because of the sort of focus on the personality of somebody like Zuck or Sheryl Sandberg or whatever, who obviously are key and critical players here, but we've heard a lot about their story. So anyway, I hope that there's another way to do this at some point.
I love that. I too have written a TV treatment, but mine is about a small town that becomes a haven for burnt out executives, not just tech, but like all sorts of ones. So like the mayor is a former vice president who's on his third wife that he met at Burning Man. Like the mechanic created the self-driving car. It's called Tired of the Grind because the main character is a burnt out tech exec who decides to open a coffee shop because she thought she just wanted this sort of like 9 to 5, the job doesn't come home with you type of.
Did you do this after you left?
I started working on it. So the idea actually started evolving at Facebook. We were, so I always had this daydream. I was like, maybe I'll just go back to Wisconsin and open a bait shop, right? Like when it's really stressed out and you needed like a little escapism fantasy of like, if I'm not going to do this. And then we were sitting around the office around the Iowa caucuses in 2016. And somehow this came up and everyone started going around saying what their thing would be. And then somebody was like, this would make a great TV show. And then I decided to actually write a treatment on it and start developing characters. And now this is a very fun dinner party thing for me to bring up, because even to this day, I rarely have overlaps in what people are picking to be their thing. I have somebody who's going to run a golf course. I've got a marina captain. Like, I've got all sorts of different things of what people want to do. And so it's kind of a fun conversation of like, if you weren't doing this, what would you like do in your dream escapism fantasy?
Yeah. Wasn't there a movie like where the president moved, like a former president moved to a small town and like, I don't know, in the Northeast? I don't know. I don't remember. Yeah.
I don't know. Mine's kind of like a mix of like Parks and Rec, Gilmore Girls and Schitt's Creek, like, you know, that kind of combo. So I didn't put this on. I'm not going to ask you if you have anything off the top of your head of what your thing would be. I more than welcome it, but I also don't want to put you on the spot.
So I think it would be one of two things. One, it would be running like a nice cocktail bar, or it would be like arborist, like taking care of trees. Like I love trees. So one of those two. Maybe you can do both.
We can certainly make that happen.
Okay, that's right. In your small town in Wisconsin,
Well, this one, I have it based in a town called Maplewood in Colorado. I have no idea if there's an actual Maplewood that exists. But anyways, well, Brian, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Yeah, Katie, thanks for having me. It's really great. I've been a listener for a long time, and it's awesome to be here.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Impossible Trade-Offs. You can find the show notes and everything for this podcast on my Substack at anchorchange.substack.com. I want to thank my guests for doing this. And this episode was edited by Claude Jennings Jr. I hope you all have a great day, and thank you so much.